Welcome to Milk and Honey with Jesse Shazlow, the show all about Israel, anti-Semitism, and Jewish culture. Sponsored by the Jewish Federation of Sarasota Manatee. Now, here's your host, Jesse Shazlow.
Good morning, and welcome to Milk and Honey, sponsored by the Jewish Federation of Sarasota Manatee. I'm Joan Lowry, your guest host for today's program. Once a month, Milk and Honey focuses on the Holocaust. Our interviews are pre-recorded, as they're also part of video testimonies being archived by the Florida Holocaust Museum. Today, my guest is Holocaust survivor Steen Metz of Sanibel Island. Steen was only 5 years old when the Nazis invaded Denmark in 1940. In October 1943, 3 years after the Nazi occupation, Steen and his family were arrested and deported to Theresienstadt concentration camp in Czechoslovakia. While Theresienstadt was called a work camp, not an extermination camp, many people died there of starvation and hard labor. Steen is here to tell us his story about life before, during, and after the war. Good morning, Steen.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Steen, you were just a little boy when the Nazi invasion occurred. Tell me about what your life was like in Denmark prior to the Nazi occupation.
Oh, prior to the occupation, life was very, very normal. I would play with other children. We would go on summer holiday. As a matter of fact, the other day, in my album, I saw a picture of myself during a summer holiday the year before we got arrested. And you wouldn't think that we were occupied by the Nazis at that time.
Were you part of a Jewish community, or did you live with non-Jews as well?
I was not part of a Jewish community. There were very few Jewish people living in my hometown, Odense. As a matter of fact, I didn't know I was Jewish. I was not brought up in the Jewish faith. Both my parents were Jewish. My father was brought up in the Jewish faith, but my mother was not.
Interesting. Were they both from Denmark?
Yes. Oh, yes. They're both from Copenhagen. The entire family, on both my mother and father's side, they lived in the Copenhagen area.
Was that pretty true of all the Jewish families in Denmark, that they weren't particularly religious in any way?
No, there was some people that were more religious than others. There were some Orthodox people. Like I mentioned, my father was brought up in the Jewish mm-hmm. faith, but didn't observe the Jewish religion when he moved to Odense, which was kind of difficult because we didn't have a temple. It was probably very difficult to get kosher food. But his two brothers in Copenhagen, they continued to observe the Jewish faith.
What did your father do for a living?
He was an attorney. He came from Copenhagen, and my mother and father got married in Copenhagen, and then he got a job in Odense.
Odense?
Yes.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, you're doing very
Odense.
Well.
So you weren't aware that you were Jewish, and even during the occupation, did you become aware that you were Jewish?
No, I didn't become aware of it until we were arrested.
Really?
Which was early morning of October 2nd. I did not know until then that I was Jewish.
Interesting. So just before we get into the arrest, did you hear anything? You were very young, but did you hear anything with your parents being worried, since the Nazis were occupying Denmark, about being Jewish?
I didn't hear anything. And don't forget, the communications were very, very different in those days than they are today. Mm-hmm. Today, whatever happens in the world, everybody knows it a couple of seconds later. So I was not aware of them being concerned about it.
You understand that we understand now that the Danes were very against the Nazi occupation. So, in retrospect, what can you tell me about the environment on the parts?
Oh,
of the
there were, first of all, when the Nazis invaded Denmark, there was a non-aggression pact between Hitler and Denmark, and of course, you won't be surprised when I tell you that didn't mean anything. He invaded Denmark. And there wasn't much of a battle going on because we didn't have the forces to fight the war machine from Germany, and surrendered the same day. And later on, there were a lot of young people that formed the resistance movement, underground movement. starting to make life miserable for the Nazis. So I mean, none of the Danes liked the Danes. There were some informers. There were some young women that loved to have boyfriends in among the Nazis. But that was very much the exception.
So weren't, I would imagine, though, that the Germans were really upset about the resistance movement.
Oh, they became very, very upset as it accelerated. And as a result, the commandant in Denmark gave an ultimatum to the Danish government. The Danish government had continued to govern, and the Danish king had continued to rule, which was very unusual compared to other occupied countries. And the ultimatum they gave to the Danish government was that they had to arrest the saboteurs and they had to sentence them to death. And no way would they accept that, and they surrendered. And that became the beginning of the roundup of the Danish Jews.
So it was almost how ironic that, that the Danes wanted to help the Jews, and yet by helping them so much, it brought on the arrests.
In a way, it is very, very ironic. But there are a number of things that were ironic in Denmark, because a leading Nazi officer leaked the word that the roundup was upcoming, leaked it to the Danish administration. It was relayed at the synagogue in Copenhagen. Mm-hmm. And most of the Jewish people lived in Copenhagen. And as a result, about 95% of the Danish Jews, or around 7,000, managed to escape to Sweden. Sweden was a neutral country.
They escaped by sea, correct?
They escaped by sea. Many of them by fishing boats from many different places. Some of them just outside Copenhagen, some of them north, some of them south.
But in your town, obviously you didn't know about the arrest.
We didn't
coming.
Know about it. We had not been warned, as far as I've been able to determine. And it was very fortunate so many people were able to escape with the help of the Danish people. But it was unfortunate that we were in the minority among the 5%.
The 5%? 5%. Wow. So there were like 70. There were 7,500 Jews,
that's right,
living in Denmark.
About 7,000 in round numbers managed to escape, and 470 Danish Jews were arrested.
Just to backtrack a little bit more, is it true that the Jewish people did not have to wear the Star of David because the king opposed it?
It is true that we didn't have to wear the Jewish star. I don't think it's true that the king didn't want the Danish Jews to wear it. He was very, very supportive of the Danish Jews. And many people think that the king actually wore a Danish star in support of the Danish people. But that's a myth. That is not the case. But he was very, very supportive, and it was very, very unique. Most of the kings, the royal couples, escaped, fled to England or Sweden. Mm-hmm. In Denmark, they stayed behind.
Now, the Danish resistance is actually honored at Yad Vashem in Israel, isn't it, as the righteous among nations?
Absolutely. And at a museum in Skokie, the Danish people are honored for what they did, helping the Danish people to escape, including a couple that managed to save many Danes and got fishing boat for them, managed to send them to Sweden.
So many of the Holocaust survivors I've interviewed from other countries felt very resentful about the countries they came from because the countries were not supportive. But I wonder how you feel about your Danish roots.
Oh, I'm very proud of.
I would think
I'm
so.
Very proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as an example, in Denmark, the Danish police helped the Danish Jews escape to Sweden. In Hungary or other countries, the local police would help arrest the Jews, so it's quite a contrast.
Did the Jews have a long history in Denmark?
Yes, they had quite a long history. Some of them came from Russia many years ago, and some of them from other parts of Eastern Europe. And there were also a number of young people that escaped from Germany and Austria earlier, and they worked on different places in Denmark, learning agriculture. Intention was for them to end up in Palestine.
Interesting. So you were 8 years old when the Nazi arrests and imprisonments occurred. As you said, it was October the 2nd?
Yes.
1945, during Rosh Hashanah, during
That's
the Jewish
exactly
New Year.
Right. That's exactly right.
Tell me about that day.
Well, first of all, the Germans were very proud of their planning, so they expected, being Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year, that all the Danish Jews would be home. Fortunately, that was not the case, but we were home, unfortunately. And I still remember the pounding on our door. And as I mentioned earlier, I didn't know what was going on. And I didn't realize we were Jewish. And when I talk to students, I always tell them, is it a crime to be Jewish? Of course, it's not a crime, but it's a crime in the mind of Hitler's evil mind.
If you wouldn't mind, so what was it like? How many German soldiers came to the door? What were you told?
I believe there were three in total, Gestapo officers, and they gave us about half an hour to get ready. And my mother and I were allowed to go downstairs. We lived on the third floor in an apartment, to the baker, and we got some pastries and rolls. And the baker was very kind to help us out. He even offered to try and help my mother and I escape. Technically, it might have been possible because there was a hallway in the basement. But of course, my mother couldn't agree to do that because my father was up in the apartment and he would have been shot. But this tells you the kind of people the Danes were. It was very courageous of the baker.
Indeed. It's time for us to take a short break. Steen, I want to thank Triforce Pictures for their generosity in providing video and audio services for the Holocaust testimonies. This is Milk and Honey on WSRQ, the voice of Sarasota, Manatee.
A regular crowd shuffles in. There's an old man sitting next to me, making love to his tonic and gin.
Welcome back to Milk and Honey. I'm your host, Joan Lowry. I'm talking with Danish Holocaust survivor Steen Metz. And before the break, Steen was talking about the day that the Nazis came and incarcerated Steen and his mother and father. So where did they take you?
Initially, they took us to a schoolyard in Odense, and we were assembled there with about 60 other Jewish people, many of them young people. Actually, they're Jews that came from Austria or Germany, as I mentioned earlier. Afterwards, we were transferred to the western part of Denmark, and we were herded into a cattle car, and we spent the next 3 days and three nights in the cattle car. I was frightened. I believe the adults were frightened as well, and they didn't give us any food, they didn't give us anything to drink, and it was completely dark, there was no window.
How did people relate to each other in the car?
They were all frightened, and they had no idea what was going on. I didn't know, and the longer it took, the more frightened everybody became because they didn't know where we were going. But again, there was a nice feeling in there because there were, while most of the people we didn't know, but we all shared whatever food we had, like the products from the bakery we shared, and some people had a packed lunch. So we shared with everybody.
Did anybody die in the cattle car?
Not in our cattle car, but I understand in other cattle cars there were people that died. I understand there was also a person that committed suicide.
In the car?
In the car.
My goodness.
Not in our car, but in another car.
Wow. So 3 days, three nights, you don't know where you're going. Then all of a sudden the doors open. What happens next?
We did get, I should add, we did get
one stop.
We got some fresh air, we got some water, and then back again in the cattle car. And then we ended up in Terezin. It's Terezin, that's the Czech version. Theresienstadt is the German version. And we ended up in Theresienstadt and spent the next 18 months there.
So you got out. Did they have, like they did at the extermination camps? I understand Theresien was not an extermination camp, but did they kind of separate people? You go one way, you go another way?
No. As I understand it, that was basically in the extermination camps they did that. But we were not separated like that. We were separated, men, women, children, and seniors. And somehow my mother was able to convince the authorities that I should stay with her, which was very, very unique.
Did she ever tell you how she convinced?
No, and I wish I had an opportunity to talk to her, but like most survivors or liberators, we didn't really talk that much about it right after the war. I mean, we did exchange some talk, but no, I still don't know why.
So were you the only male in the barracks with your mother and the
On the loft where we were staying, I was the only one. There would have been others on other lofts, but on this one, I was the only one. I was 8 years old at the time.
Tell me about how many people were in the barracks, what it was like, the environment inside the barracks, and then we'll talk about the rest of the environment.
In the loft where we were.
The loft?
The loft. We were in the loft. It was about 90 people there, and we slept on bunk beds, wooden bunk beds, and they called it straw mattresses, but there was very little straw in the mattresses. We were basically lying on the wood. It was hard, and there were lice, there were fleas. Oh. And I don't remember some of it, but my mother afterwards told me, when we did talk, that I would be scratching my hands and my arms and didn't quite understand what was going on, because at home in Odense, I never did that.
Did winter came?
Yes.
Did they give you blankets, or was it freezing?
We had some thin blankets.
Boy, what about food?
We got very little food. We got, for breakfast, we would get substitute coffee with a chunk of bread. At lunch, we would line up. I refer to it as a soup kitchen. And we would bring our bowls with our wooden spoons, and we would stand in line for, I don't know, 20 minutes, half an hour, or whatever. And then we would get what they called potato soup. It was really boiled water with potato peel. And basically the same at dinner. Occasionally, we would get a German dish, a dumpling, a pasta dish.
So you were starving?
We were close to starving. I mean, there were people, 40,000 out of 140,000 inmates in the camp. They died, many of them from starvation, malnutrition, also from illnesses.
So what did you do? Did you have a job? Did your mother have a job?
Everybody worked. My father worked. He was an attorney, as we said earlier, and suddenly he was exposed to some heavy work digging ditches in the road. It was very hard for him because he didn't get much to eat, and he was used to office work. He was used to litigating in the courthouse, and he lost about 50% of his body weight, and he passed away after less than 6 months.
Wow. Did you have any, did they tell you? Did you even know that at the time?
My mother told me.
She found out.
She found out, and she had to identify his body. And unfortunately, she didn't know what to do with me, so I went along.
Were you able, it's just tragic, were you able to see your father before he died at any point?
He was in infirmary. I didn't see him there, but I did see him a few times before he passed away.
Wow. And your mother, what did she do?
She worked different jobs. She had factory jobs. To my knowledge, she was not physically abused, but my father was whipped. He was physically abused. And an officer came over when he worked, was in the beginning of the winter, and they tore his winter coat off him. My mother worked in a factory, and they worked with a mineral called mica. And they would slice it up, and it would be used as insulation material.
Who were the guards? Were they Czech or German?
Oh, they were Nazis. They were Germans.
They were all Germans.
I mean, there were some Czech gendarmes on the outskirts of the camp, but all the guards were German. Mm. Mm.
And you did some work.
Yes, I did. I was a gopher or messenger. I didn't have to work. I was 8 years old, but my mother thought it would be a good idea because time would pass faster. So, and when I talk to students, I always have to remind them, in those days, we didn't have computers, we didn't have TVs, certainly didn't have iPhones. So my job was to take some German documents, and I would pass them on to other Nazi officers.
How did they treat you?
I was not physically abused, and I just left them, and I couldn't get out of there fast enough.
Mm-hmm. How many hours a day did you work?
Oh, maybe a couple of hours in the morning, a couple of hours in the afternoon.
So I have been to Theresien, and they say that there was a lot of, there was music and arts. It was all clandestine on the part of the survivors in the camp. Is that true? Did you see that?
Well, a lot of artists in camp. Yeah. There were musicals there, especially towards the end when the international delegation arrived in camp.
Well, that was for show, right?
That was strictly for show.
But I want to talk about that in a minute. But aside from that, did they have an arts life? Were they able to keep this up and the Nazis didn't know about it?
Some of them were able to keep it up. A lot of the children were drawing, they were writing poets. There were an inordinate amount of artists and musicians in the camp.
Interesting. I wonder why.
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure why.
Wow. So there was, and that was a famous event in history when the Red Cross came to the camp along with, I believe, some Swedish representative to see, and it was a whole hoax. Tell us about that.
I like to call it infamous because it was propaganda that was put on by the Germans, the Nazis. They beautified the town. They sent older people, frail people to extermination camps. They imported some young French children, looked very healthy, and they had nice clothes on, and they were playing, and they put on a musical, Wunderbar, and a camp was beautified, walls were painted.
You remember all that?
I remember some of it, and some of it I don't remember. I read about or have researched, or my mother opened up the year before she was passed away and talked to some young journalists. And I'm very fortunate I have the tape. So it's a combination.
Was that one time that the Red Cross came, or did it?
It was only, they came later on also. But the big day was June 23rd, 1944. There were two representatives from Denmark, from the Red Cross, and there was a doctor from Switzerland.
Switzerland. So I've read about that, and there's some question about whether the Red Cross went for that or just went along with it. Do you have any sense of that?
Oh, my sense is, and it's been confirmed by some other historians, I've done research on it, that they didn't see through it. And I could understand if they didn't want to say anything right away, because if they had talked about it as soon as they got back, maybe the Danes would be executed. But even well after the war, there were videos, they were interviewed, and they still didn't realize that they were...
Really? So it wasn't that they were in cahoots in any way. One other question before we take a break. Some of the children in the camp, some of your friends, were sent to Auschwitz, correct?
Yes, that is correct. Some of my Czech friends, I played soccer on the gravel field. Of course, we didn't have a real soccer ball, but the mothers put some old clothes together and tied it up, and we kicked it around. And one day they didn't show up, and I didn't know about the deportation at that time. And it was very sad. They were deported.
Very, very sad. It's time to take another break. We'll be back shortly to find out more about Holocaust survivor Steen Metz's experience during the Holocaust. Before we break, I want to thank Triforce Pictures for their generosity in providing video and audio services for the Holocaust testimonies. This is Milk and Honey on WSRQ, the voice of Sarasota, Manatee.
You know I'm bad at communication. It's the hardest thing for me to do, and it's the most important part that relationships will go through. And I give it all away just so I could say that.
Welcome back to Milk and Honey. I'm your host, Joan Lowry. I'm talking with Holocaust survivor Steen Metz. Right before the break, you were talking about some of your friends from the camp, some Czech children being sent to Auschwitz. How did you manage to stay? You were a little child, too.
We were very lucky, but we didn't realize at the time. And I wasn't old enough to really think about or know about it. And my mother was hiding it. But most of the Danes didn't realize there was an agreement made between the commandant, Werner Best in Denmark, and Adolf Eichmann, that they didn't want to send any Danes to any extermination camps. And the reason was they didn't want to send any more resources to Denmark. And if they had sent any Danes, they were afraid that there would be more of an uproar, an accelerated resistance movement.
Let me see if I understand this. So they actually kept better care of the Danes in the sense of not killing them because they were worried there would be such an uproar from the Danes that it would backfire on them.
I don't know if we were treated better to this extent that we were not, none of us were sent to extermination camps. But I didn't know it for years. I think my mother went to her grave when she was almost 90 years old, not knowing about it.
Very
and I read some books right afterwards, and they were wondering why none of the Danes were sent away.
Interesting. So, so they all survived. No, they didn't all survive. Your father didn't
survive. My father didn't survive. There were about 50 Danes that died, most of them the first 6 months.
Was there tuberculosis in the camp as
well? There was extensive TB in the camp. And there were a total of, I think I mentioned that earlier, 40,000 that died of starvation and illnesses, mostly TB.
Amazing.
And then there were 90,000 people, children, mothers, fathers, that were deported to extermination camps.
Yes. So right before liberation, I understand they were building a crematorium at Theresienstadt. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. There was a crematorium built much earlier because they ran out of space, so they started cremating all the bodies, including my father's. But then there was a gas chamber that was built in the early part of April. And I'd heard rumors about it when I wrote my book, which I finished in 2011. And I didn't believe it, and I was trying to get it confirmed. And I talked to a person who had been to Theresienstadt from Czechoslovakia, 10 years older than me. And she confirmed that in April, Hitler wanted to eliminate, April 45, wanted to eliminate all the Jewish people. And they started making gas chambers and was supposed to be operational in the middle of May. And we were liberated April the 15th and the camp was liberated May the 8th. So it's very, very eerie to hear about those.
Just in time. Yeah. When you say that you were liberated April 15th, but the camp May 5th.
The Red Cross.
May 8th, rather.
Mm-hmm. The Red Cross from Sweden sent white buses to several camps, and they were able to convince the Nazi authorities that they were able to save about 15,000 lives from different camps, including the Danes, at that time about 423, I think, from Theresienstadt. And the buses arrived on April the 15th.
I see. Is there any particular symbolism about the white buses?
Yes, the white buses is... And with Red Cross, basically to tell the allies, don't bomb the white buses.
Wow.
And make sure there's a Red Cross on the side. And I understand there were some of the Germans that painted their cars and trucks white because they didn't want to be bombed.
Interesting.
They probably knew that it was close to the end of the war.
So you went to Sweden?
Yes, we could not stay in Denmark because Denmark was still occupied.
So what happened in Sweden?
We came to Sweden on April the 18th. We were in quarantine for the first week or so, wanted to make sure we didn't bring any illnesses in. And then later on, we reconnected with my family who had escaped to Sweden. And then as far as Denmark was concerned, the Germans surrendered on May the 5th, 1945. And a couple of weeks later, my mother and I returned to Denmark.
So you were only in Sweden for a short while?
Short while, yeah.
And what happened when you got back to Denmark? Were you able to get your property back? So many people weren't in other countries.
We lived in a rented apartment, and mm-hmm. the apartment had been rented out. There was shortage of an apartment. My mother managed to get a smaller apartment for us. I believe the legal company where my father worked helped out. Most of our belongings had been stored by the legal company where my father worked. So in many ways, I mean, we're very, very fortunate. I often think about it. If the Allies hadn't invaded Normandy, you and I would not be able to to have this talk. So we were very, very lucky.
What did the Danes do for the returning Jews?
Oh, they helped us out. We stayed with some friends. There was a teacher that took me under her wings, gave me some private lessons because there was no official schooling in Theresienstadt. And they couldn't help us enough,
mm-hmm.
which is quite contrary, I understand, to the returning Jews in Poland, as an example.
Some of them were killed, and their property was taken away, and they had pogroms.
Yeah.
So it's just the completely wonderful story you're telling, relatively.
Yes.
Did you talk? You mentioned earlier that you didn't talk much. Did you talk about what happened with your mother, with others?
Very little. When some friends came around, my mother would always say, "Don't ask Dean, ask me." She wanted to focus on the future. You don't forget. And I think in school, some people are asking me, didn't the school friends ask? And I'm sure my mother had talked to the principal in the school and asked her not to talk about it.
So they thought that by not talking about it, you wouldn't be plagued by it. But did it continue to plague you, or were you able to bracket what happened?
I was able to block it out after a while. Fortunately enough, because I lived in Odense and there were very few Jewish people there, and there were none in my school, and so we didn't really talk about it. If I lived in Copenhagen and gone to synagogue in Copenhagen and gone to school with Jewish friends, I think it would have been quite different.
So
I would have been reminded.
Yeah, as someone who was not raised, even aware that you were Jewish, having no Jewish background, did you become more curious about what it was to be a Jew or less curious?
Right afterwards, I really... Both my mother and I, we didn't want to have anything to do with the Jewish, being Jewish right after the war when we were liberated, because there was only one reason why we were in camp and one reason why I lost my father, and it was because we were Jewish.
How did your mother and you cope with the loss of your father?
It was very difficult, and I'm not so sure I fully appreciated how difficult it was for my mother, because she was a single parent, and she had to go out and work. She worked in a factory initially to support the family. So I think it was a lot more difficult for her.
Mm-hmm. And ultimately she remarried?
Yes, she remarried when I was 16 years old.
Mm-hmm. And what about you? So you were behind in school, but you mentioned some teacher helped you to catch up. What happened in terms of your education?
I was able to go back to my old classmates. I missed most of third and fourth grade, but I was able to go back. And I think that's another reason why it helped transform. I'm not saying life was normal, but it helped a great deal to have my old friends around as opposed to going to another class.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you think that your old friends were told not to ask you questions about what...
I don't know. And there are many times when I wish I could wake up my mother and ask her some question. I don't know. I have a feeling they were asked not to.
Yeah, because and you didn't feel like you wanted to talk about it anyway.
No, I mean, if somebody asked me, I would talk about it. But I wouldn't hide it. But if they didn't ask, you're not going around and say, by the way, I was in the camp.
You slept okay at night? You didn't have nightmares or anything like that?
I was lucky. I didn't have nightmares. My mother told me that I was hanging on to her skirt. Mm-hmm. I had some abandonment issues, still have some of those anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
But I was afraid that something would happen to my mother. What would happen to me, because my father was no longer there.
Sure. So you went to school, you went to business college in Copenhagen?
Yes.
And tell me about your career and what happened next.
I went to business school in Copenhagen, which I just loved. Unfortunately, I was just doing it for a couple of years because I was very interested in tennis. I was quite good as a junior, and I was able to play quite a bit of tennis there, and I wanted to continue to do it. But eventually, I joined a Danish company, and they were in the food business, and about 95% of their business was abroad. And I wanted to get kind of expand my horizons. And they sent me to England first. If you don't do well in England, it's not too far to send you back.
Yeah.
And apparently, I did all right. Came to Canada. I spent a little over 2 years in Canada. And I got married in Canada, and we actually got married just before I was transferred to the United States.
I'm going to take a break. We'll come back and talk about that. We'll be back shortly to find out more about what happened in the rest of your life. I want to again thank Triforce Pictures for their generosity in providing video and audio services for the Holocaust testimonies. This is Milk and Honey on WSRQ, the voice of Sarasota, Manatee. Welcome back to Milk and Honey. I'm your host, Joan Lowry, and I'm talking with Holocaust survivor Steen Metz. Before the break, Steen was talking about going to business college, going to work for a food company, and starting to travel and work for them around the world, and meeting your wife, who's, is she British?
She's British.
She's from Britain. Is she Jewish?
No, she's not.
Right. So you got married, and then somehow you ended up in the United States. How did you end up here?
Oh, the food company I work for in Canada transferred me to the United States. And we actually got married some months earlier than we had planned originally because of the transfer. And we wanted to get married in Canada, where we had our friends there. Neither of us wanted to go. We had a great life in Canada. We loved it. But I'm glad I agreed to the transfer. I didn't have much of a choice because mm-hmm. they had sponsored me. So it would have been, almost impossible for me to get a job with somebody else.
Yeah, and didn't you end up being president of a division?
That was much later.
That was much later.
It wasn't a division of that company. It was a division of the McCormick company.
I see. Yeah. But the McCormick Spice Company?
McCormick Spice Company.
So you stayed essentially in the food business.
In the food business all my life.
Right. Now you had two daughters, correct?
That's correct.
So during that time, in their upbringing, did you talk to your wife about what happened during the Holocaust? Did you talk to your girls?
She knew it because on our very first date, I told her I was Jewish, mm-hmm. and I'd never done that before, so I must have known it was serious. I never told any other girlfriends that I was Jewish.
How did she respond?
She was surprised, but it wasn't a problem. I think I wanted it out of the way if it was a problem, but it was not a problem. As far as our children are concerned, but I would talk to Eileen, my wife, I would tell her about it, but she didn't know all the details. Our children knew about it, but they didn't know all the details either.
They didn't know because you didn't want to talk about it.
I wasn't that forthcoming, which was very, very common, which sounds strange if you're not being in my shoes, but that's the case with most survivors. And most liberators, they really don't want to talk about it.
Did you, at that time, have vivid memories about the Holocaust, or was it sort of receding into the background?
It was kind of put in the back because I was married, we had children, I was busy at work, I was having a nice professional career, I was advancing, and I was traveling. And I played a lot of tennis, so there was It's a lot of activity, which is probably good.
But you did mention something significant about abandonment issues, what you still had. So I imagine that's how it came.
Yes, anxiety, And Eileen, my wife, if she was going out at night, for example, and mm-hmm. pick up the children or go out or over the weekend, I would always ask her when she would be back. And if she said she would be back by 4, I would be concerned. Mm. And anxious if she wasn't back at 4 o'clock. And I still have those
yes,
problems.
Yes. Did you have flashbacks at all?
No.
Good. Yeah, good. So you kept that secret or relatively down. And then one day, and I want to understand why, you started talking about the Holocaust. You felt a mission, a calling.
Yes.
So what happened?
I just have to go back a little bit. I started writing my memoirs for my family in 2007. Then I started coming to the war years, the mm-hmm. occupation. And of course, I had to write about that. I had to do some research. I had some holes to fill in. And I got more and more involved in it. And from a time when I didn't want to read anything about it or talk to anybody about it, now I couldn't read enough. So when I finished the book, I took the chapters about the Holocaust and put it in a separate book. I called it A Danish Boy in Theresienstadt, Reflections of a Holocaust Survivor, and I put that in a separate book. Then my children would read my memoirs, and of course they read about the Holocaust, and they knew some, but they didn't know all of it, so they learned something new.
How did they respond to that, finding out what you had gone through?
I think in many ways they would have liked to have known about it earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I wasn't ready, and mm-hmm. Eileen wasn't ready either, because she felt very bad for me about it. So back in October 2011, 6 months after my book was self-published, Annalise, my oldest daughter, she had a son, my grandson, in middle school, and she talked to the teacher. The teacher asked me to come in and talk about it. I was very hesitant. I didn't know that I really wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. I was used to talking to adults, to business people. I didn't know how the students would behave. Would they listen? Would they play with their iPhones? So I went in there, the presentation, quite different to the one I make today. I was reading passages, and the students were great. They were very, very respectful. They were very attentive. They asked great questions. And afterwards, my daughter said, "Oh, you did a great job." She'd never heard me talk. "Oh, that was just wonderful." And my grandson had a friend, I believe he was Jewish, in his class. And apparently the friend came over to Alex, my grandson, said, "Oh, your grandpa, he was just superb. He was awesome," I think was the word. And that kind of clinched it. Mm-hmm. And since then, I keep track, like, you know, in business, you keep track of your yes. objectives. So I talked to about 220 groups, and I'm approaching 25,000 people, wow. So mostly students.
What does it do for you when you tell these stories?
It gives me a great deal of satisfaction. It helps talk about it. I cannot imagine going to the grave without having written the book, really open up about it. And I went back to Terrasson to do some research, and I'm glad I went back there. And sometimes when I come back, I talk to Eileen, my wife. Some of the questions the students ask are phenomenal, especially the middle schoolers.
What are some of the questions, for example?
Oh, there was a middle school student. He asked me, "Do you feel guilty or lucky being alive?" From a 13-year-old student. And I answered it, "Maybe I should feel guilty, but I don't. But I feel very, very lucky." Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorite questions.
Yeah.
Another question is, have you ever forgiven the Nazis? And I've had that several times. And no, I could never forgive the Nazis. No way. They were responsible for the death of 6 million Jews, including my father, and millions of others. I could never forgive them.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's human to forgive, but I strongly disagree. We all have our own opinion. There's another survivor, Eva Kaur.
Yes, I've interviewed her.
Oh, you heard? Mm-hmm. She came to the area mm-hmm. Some months ago and talked. And I've seen pictures of her embracing a Nazi officer in court. And she's forgiving all of them. I'm not saying I'm right or she's wrong, but I have some very strong feelings
about
that.
Yeah, I think in her case, because I've talked to her extensively about it, it's more a matter of she needed it to do it for her own. She doesn't forgive what they did, but she had to forgive them for her own psyche to survive. But it's very complex, and I don't pretend to understand
it
all. I do want to, one thing you said about writing your memoirs. Now, do you think that there was a part of you that wanted to approach? It sounds like you didn't know how deeply you'd get into the Holocaust, but not everybody decides to write their memoirs. Do you think that was a part of you that was saying, face this now?
When I got into it, not in the beginning, because in the beginning I hadn't thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to write memoirs for my family. But when I got into it, there's no question about it. The timing has to be right, and it was right for me.
It's, yeah, very much so. In your opinion, do you have any sense of why this happened in that point in history? Do you have any, after in all your research, why did such a horrendous event happen?
Oh, there are a number of reasons. I believe Hitler felt that Germany was not treated right after the First World War. Maybe he forgot that Germany lost the war. They initiated the war, they lost the war.
Mm-hmm.
It was a peace treaty in Versailles. He felt that a lot of Jewish people were responsible for the way Germany was treated. And that's one reason. Number one, I think he has a very evil mind, and he was envious, he was jealous of some of the Jewish people that tended to be very successful, mm-hmm. as doctors or entertainment or merchants. So those were some of the reasons. I also believe what happened to the Armenians in Turkey in 1915 has something to do with it. Mm-hmm. Many mm-hmm. people feel that that was used as a model for Hitler.
Yeah, I've read that as well. Boy, there's so much we could continue to talk. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. I do want to say that you have a website, and the address is www.steenmetzneverforget.com. I don't want to leave without that if anybody wants to get in touch with you. And I want to thank you for sharing such a compelling story with us here. Thank you very much. And special thanks to Triforce Pictures for their generosity in providing video and audio services for the Holocaust testimonies. They make feature films, commercials, business videos, and wonderfully crafted wedding films. The Jewish Federation of Sarasota Manatee is a nonprofit organization whose mission is saving Jewish lives and enhancing Jewish life in Sarasota Manatee, Israel, and around the world. If you missed part of this program and would like to listen again, a podcast will be available Monday afternoon on WSRQradio.com and on our website, which is jfedsrq.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for devoting your time to the project. I appreciate
it. Pleasure.